Thank you. Welcome to those who are on the call. We are broadcasting live from New York City. I'm sitting here with Michelle Cahill, who is a Distinguished Fellow in Education and Youth Development at the National Center for Civic Innovation. I'm also joined at the table with by the two co-founders or co-leaders of the Readiness Project, Caitlin Johnson and Stephanie Krause, who will be aptly fielding questions as they come in over the Twitter hashtag, and will inject their own questions as they feel free. So we do encourage you to send your questions in throughout the call. This is, as the advertisement said, totally unscripted, totally free. It'll be up to you to decide whether it's totally inspiring, but I know that I'm inspired to be sitting here with Michelle. Michelle has joined us at the national meeting, for those of you who were able to join us in New Orleans, and this call was set up really by popular demand. We had Michelle on a panel talking about youth development in schools and what it takes to really embed youth development in schools. And the short response that we got and the feedback was, we need to hear more from Michelle. So we've traveled here to New York to make sure we can do that. Michelle and I go back, I think, almost 40 years, 35 years. We're getting close in there. And I can say without a doubt that Michelle has done more than anyone I know to really focus on this idea of how we embed youth development principles, including a focus on what folks are calling those non-academic outcomes, how we embed these principles in school systems and encourage school and CBO partnerships that put these principles into daily practice. And you're going to hear us emphasize that practice word throughout. Michelle has done this from pretty much every vantage point. She's done it from the foundation. She's headed up both national and local youth development intermediaries, and she took her stint inside of one of the largest public school systems here in New York City. And so with that amount of experience, the only question we can start with is, Michelle, what lessons have you learned? You clearly think this is important because you've spent your life doing it, but is it doable?
Thank you, Karen, and good morning, everyone. It's very exciting and a real set indicator for optimism that so many people are joining us this morning in this conversation. The number of registrants, when I heard there were 700 registrants, it just gave me a sense of movement building about how important this is. So as Karen said, I've been doing this for a while from different vantage points. So the essential truth about schooling and youth development is that young people are persons who are developing, and they are at a particular stage of life and development when an integration of their socio-emotional lives and their academic lives and their academic experiences is essential for their growth and learning. And schools are the social context in which this occurs or has to occur. And so seeing youth development as a project or program that gets added to school is a very limited way. It can be an important way in the sense that there can be very important programs for young people. But essentially what we need to begin with, or what lesson is learned, is that youth development is an ongoing process that all adolescents are going through to form identities and build competencies. And it's incredibly important for them, and a much harder job than in the past for educators and people concerned with the education of young people, to bring all young people to the kind of competencies that we need in today's world. And so understanding how we can motivate, engage, and get them to put out, to invest in themselves and their own learning is absolutely essential. That's the first lesson.
So let me pull that lesson apart a little bit and see if this phrase rings true to you. What I hear you saying, and what certainly I believe and have experienced, as have a lot of the folks on the phone, is that what we've been trying to do for the past several decades is figure out how you bring what folks have fundamentally described, as you did, a youth development approach into an educational system. Mm-hmm. So what happens, what do you do to get an approach embedded in a system? And mm-hmm. to put it another way, how do we take the huge lessons that we've learned about the fact that we can be intentional in defining and teaching people to do good developmental practice? How do you actually get developmental practice codified into the official practice of a system, whether that's a school system or a workforce development system or a juvenile justice system? How do we bring developmental practice into official practice? Mm-hmm.
So let me take it from three elements.
Okay.
Okay. And the first is, what do we know about that? What do we know about that from research and from professional experience and learning over the years? The second is, what's the implication for practices? And the third is, what's the implication for structures, right? So the task we have is to make it possible for adults to take a youth development approach, and feasible, right? So giving the kinds of conditions. So first of all, when I say, what do we know from research and professional experience, we know so much more than we used to know. The advances in cognitive science, learning sciences, have showed us so much more, both how the brain works during adolescence, how people learn, and how important motivation is to that learning, and the interaction of emotional life and the importance of relationships to learning, right? So youth development has always been a field that has taken an approach that what is often called non-cognitive has a really big impact in young people's lives. Intrapersonal skills, how you understand your own feelings, how you understand your own sources of motivation, intrapersonal, how you think about peers, how you get along, how respect feels in your life. And then, and we can talk more about this later, the impact of adversity and the importance of resilience, right? So socio-emotional dimensions, like bouncing back from frustration, which are really critical in learning advanced skills, right? So we know more. So we can think about these approaches being integrated more. We can think about it formally, right? And we can assess learning environments to see whether they are congruent with this new research. The second, and I'll actually go to practices, it's incredibly important for young people to form relationships with adults in which the adults are caring and invested in them, and at the very basic level, know them. Right. We have often created large, comprehensive high schools that make it very difficult for that to happen. If a teacher, let's get in a really practical level of practices, if a teacher has 180 students on her roster teaching 40-minute periods, right, or 150 or even 120, and sees them in these fragmented ways, and those same students have three different guidance counselors, right, it is very hard to get to know them and experience these kinds of caring relationships. Anyone can still be respectful, but I'm saying we're making it really hard, mm-hmm. right? And practices that enable youth to make choices and invest in what they're studying are really important as well. So the structures, I was actually talking about structures there, the benefit or downside of informal conversation, that was actually a structure part. The practices are really practices that call upon adolescents to build toward a sense of mastery and to know where they're going. So a practice in which it is made transparent to adolescents what the standards are that they are expected to meet, whether you're doing that in a youth development program mm-hmm. for a particular skill or you're doing that in math, right? Where they are and a pathway to how to get there. That is embedding a youth development approach, right? It creates a mindset that you can get there. It gives you a roadmap of how to get there. And we, you know, if we got in depth about learning practices, teaching and learning practices, we could talk about different kinds of curriculum and instructional tools that help that. But the essential thing of saying students at the center is that the young person has to participate in that. And the more that we take a youth development approach in school, the more we are always thinking about that. It's not something that happens to them.
Right. So let's drill down into that further, because, and I'm glad that you said all that, what you did, which is not surprising, is to validate the huge amount of work that the Readiness Project team, sitting here with me, plus a fleet of interns that Stephanie has ably used over the past year or so, have looked at these practices. They've done two things, and I'm going to ask Caitlin, before I even describe them, I'm going to ask Caitlin to tell folks who are near their computers where they can actually download the one sheets on these readiness abilities and practices so that you can look at them. But I'm going to take a second to sort of try to make more concrete so we can just really drill down into what we mean by practice, some of the things that Michelle just said. So, Caitlin, can you tell folks where to go?
Yes. If you go to sparkaction.org/readiness, there's a big orange bar that you click on that'll take you right to the tools with where you'll see abilities and practices. And when you open the abilities and practices, it's a PDF document. It's vibrant, it's colorful, and I think it will probably need no more introduction than that. You'll want to dig in and investigate it. It's great.
Yeah.
Again, it's sparkaction.org/readiness.
Great. Thank you, Caitlin. So one of the things that we did was to look at all of the try to take advantage of the fact, as Michelle said, that, and we haven't talked about timing, but there's something about the timing being right for making this work happen. So we want to take a little bit of time to get very specific about some of the things that Michelle said, and then I'm going to ask her why she is, as she has told me, more optimistic than ever that we can actually make this work and talk about some examples of where it really has worked and what it takes to do this. But what the team did was to essentially really look at all the things Michelle just mentioned, the huge amount of stuff that's come out around the adolescent brain research, around executive functioning, around what we know about the importance of motivation, as well as many of the sort of boutique frames that have come in about those social, emotional, non-cognitive competencies that have to be built. Not to make a new frame, but to really try to make a universal frame, and in particular, if you're able to click on this, to make one that actually is accessible to young people. So the abilities are actually written in language that young people can hear and understand. I can think and create in ways that help me navigate and experience life. And there are 10 of those. There's a huge amount of research that unbundles behind them, but our goal was to actually create and then vet a set of abilities that other folks that had frames could find their frames in and then drill down, and then to also create ones that could start a conversation with young people themselves and start to get these up on the wall. But the second piece, the practices one, is the one that I want to focus on with Michelle, because I do think we have to crack this nut of how we can help the folks who are on the front line get permission and even have incentives to bring developmental practices into their official practices. One of the nice things about, and we can always talk about the fact that after school and out of school and community programs are underfunded and under-resourced, but in some ways they had the freedom, because they were underfunded and under-resourced and not being held accountable for a lot until recently, they had the freedom, if they had the inclination, to actually do this stuff and to play with it and practice it without a lot of official constraints. They had financial constraints, but they didn't have as many official constraints. And so I think one of the things that happens when we try to bring these practices into formal systems, whether that's school, it's juvenile justice, it's child welfare, is you've got folks that already have an official manual that tells them how to create that environment, and it may not be that caring, supportive environment. It tells them how to hire and pick staff and train staff, and it may not lead to the kind of rich relationship building that you were talking about. It tells them how to set up the experiences that young people are going to go through, and those experiences may not be set up in a way that really reinforce these skills and practice. So what does it look like? I mean, give us a concrete example of what we can do to not make folks that have already been handed an official practice manual, whether that's the Common Core standards or whatever else, to actually feel that they actually have the room and could potentially be rewarded for bringing in these developmental practices. What does that look like when we try to bring these into a real system that's already got stuff that people are overwhelmed with?
There's a lot in that question, so let me try to...
You get a long time to answer it.
I know.
And I'm going to interrupt quickly and just remind folks that if you're following the hashtag ReadyYouth, you can share questions, and you'll also see a direct link to the abilities that Karen's talking about.
Okay. So let me start with Common Core standards or any learning standards, any state learning standards, right? In a way, they make me much more optimistic. Now, this do not, for people on the phone, I'm not talking about standardized testing. I'm talking about learning standards that include within them ways in which in different knowledge domains, like math, right, not to speak in jargon, right, that you can learn critical thinking. That is the kind of critical thinking that is needed for most jobs that have good earnings today and into the future, right? And if you're taking a, if you are in a school right now and you are part of a math department, you're teaching math, right? You are, and particularly if you're in a school, many, many schools, but schools that with kids who are entering high school below their academic level to be able to do college readiness type work, right? You have a very big challenge to meet. So a non-youth development way of approaching that is to say, okay, we need to get a good curriculum and we need to give all the kids who are behind double periods of math, right? And that may or may not be a good thing to do, but a useful thing to do, but it is not embodying youth development.
Mm-hmm.
A youth development approach to the same thing might use time flexibly, including more time on math. But here's a couple of examples of practices. You could identify among those students in the summer beforehand, right, a group of students to become algebra leaders for their peers. These are students, and there are real programs that do this in schools. These are young people who've never been a leader in school. They are, in fact, have real gaps, real acknowledged important gaps that have to be made up for, recuperated, right? But they do a 3-week intensive on this in which they get youth leadership development, peer leadership development, and a role in school. Now, you've already changed the structure so that there can be real relationships, whether it's small learning communities or new small schools, but something that enables a cohort of adults to be responsible and accountable and in relationship with a cohort of young people toward a path, in a pathway toward some goals, right? So these kids, you're building on the importance of peer relationships. You're building on a mindset orientation that everyone in this class can do this. Since we know the more kids think that they are in a situation where they can't do it, they don't put out the effort, right? And you're giving the teacher a bunch of young colleagues, right, who have the same goal, right? Now, you could still use the same two period time, but you'd be doing very different things.
Right.
And what you're seeing there, they're also extremely important, is that the young people are the producers. Like, they have to produce. Right? Learning doesn't take place unless any person invests themselves in learning. So that's not easy to do, but it's not impossible to do. And I think that if we approach something nationally, as well as very locally and very micro level of a school, and said, look, this is a time of tremendous change, and we have so much responsibility that we have to make it humanly possible by building on the assets and strengths that young people build. So there we're building on their capacity to lead others. They just haven't used it for academic purposes.
So let's take that actual very concrete and wonderful example, which I know happens in real life.
Right.
And let me ask you let me give you a little scale to see what it takes to make this happen. What we have found in many different settings is that when we're working with people who are, again, in systems where there's a basic official practice already going on, there's a certain amount of risk aversion that comes along with that official practice. So that if we have a continuum, on one end of the continuum, there actually could be something in the official practice that says you can't do what you just said.
Yes.
There's something really in writing, codified, that says, no, you can't do that. You can't let young people have leadership roles in the classroom. You can't do any of the things you just said, or some of them. That's probably maybe, honestly, under 10% of the time. There's another huge space in which the official practice is just silent on whether that could happen or not.
Excuse me.
Maybe that's 60% of the space. Then we've got a little bit of where that's actually named.
Mm-hmm.
You could do this so that we've come out of that silent space and said, and you could do it this way. Sure, here's the curriculum, and you've got to get young people through this curriculum, but you have the freedom to think about different ways of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the far end, we could actually provide incentives for
and support.
And support to move towards a different kind of practice. When you think about that kind of a continuum, and we're really trying to scale up the practice that you have, because right now I feel like most of it is in that non-named space.
Right.
And that means that what happens disproportionately is that the teachers or the youth workers or the caseworkers or whoever who are motivated to be in the, it doesn't say I can't, so I'm going to think that I can, are probably not as, not as plentiful as we would like, and they may be disproportionately working with the kids who don't need this the most.
Right.
So how do we do something to name this in that big space? And what have you seen that once it's actually named and allowed and people are providing these supports, they actually do it?
So it's important. What you're raising is so important, and what you're talking about is both system rules and bureaucracy, but also culture. And for many of us, it's so much harder to change cultural practices than it is to change break a rule, right? Because we don't even notice we're assuming certain things. Obviously, we need leadership. We need leadership that understands from all parts of the community that high school, as we have known it, is entrenched but obsolete for what the models are obsolete for what the job that high school has to do now, right? We used to have an economy where lots of people went from high school into industrial manufacturing work. Other people went into service work. And they got some training, right? And really, 10 years ago, we were only producing about 30% of high schools were only expected to get 20, as a whole, get 25% of their students to college, as a whole in America, right? We were dropping out 50% of the kids, right? So things are really, really changed because there's no opportunity across the lifespan without some form of post-secondary education. And so more and more leaders need to be saying this in their cities and communities, that the design is broken. And then using what many people call design thinking, which is to say, what are the principles, LES, PRIN, you know, the rules, the principles, the guiding principles for what a good high school can be. And that needs to be articulated, and leadership needs to understand it in communities and in school systems, and then assess against it. Like, what are our rules that are breaking? But also, what do we just assume that how we use time, how we use money, how people, how staffing is done that could change, and very, very importantly, how do we use community resources or assets? I think of it as assets. So if we go back to the first comments about forming an identity, right, you don't, as a young person, so many people have high aspirations, but they don't have any idea what the pathway is. So I don't know why I would want to be studying this math, because I don't actually even know that being a computer programmer requires this kind of math. Till we use the community assets, and I meet community college students who are doing it, and they tell me how they use it, or people in the world. But let me get maybe a little bit more concrete as well about what has to change. People have to see a different kind of school. So if you are in your community, right, you can go online and see some where you, I'm sure there are resources here. There are resources on the Spring Point Partners in School Design website, a tremendous number of resources, which you can look at how you could organize high school differently on a youth development approach, and also on a deeply academically challenging approach. You need system-level leadership. It requires both practices, culture, and system leadership. In New York City, where I was responsible for our secondary reform, we phased out the lowest performing comprehensive high schools, graduating students at 30%, 35%. And with community partners and with principals and teachers and others using design principles, created 200 newly designed schools inside those buildings, which are now between 10 years old and you know, 4 or 5 years old, and which have been evaluated independently for how well they're doing, and they're doing very well and graduating far more students. And they all take this youth development approach. But that took a tremendous amount of system change. Everyone is not going to be in a community that's ready for that immediately, but everyone can look at what's possible and raise issues, and also look at the assets in the community, in the informal learning space, and see what's working and see if we can apply that in at least a community conversation to generate how schools could be redesigned.
I want you to just say again, because it was embedded in a long and rich description, the fact that you were actually able in New York City to take apart low-performing comprehensive high schools and replace them with something. Just say that one more time so people hear it.
All right, there's a lot of work went into that from so many people. It was a very broad citywide effort with chancellor-level leadership, Chancellor Joel Klein, teachers' union leadership involved in it, and community leadership involved in it. What we had was a design competition asking everyone, teachers, parents, community organizations, higher education institutions, science museums, arts programs, to form teams and to propose schools that would, and New York, you from people who are in other places, we have a lot of big vertical buildings, and some of these schools then got organized into being one school per floor. New Visions for Public Schools, you can read about it on their website. They're a key partner, Urban Assembly. And the schools had to meet design characteristics of effective leadership, high-quality teaching, plans for all of, you know, for all of these that were vetted, caring relationships with adults, youth development practices, rich and rigorous curriculum, performance assessment, and porousness, P-O-R-O-U-S, porousness, so that young people would have opportunities to learn in the community. And you can read these kinds of design characteristics as well on the Spring Point Partners in School Design. Spring Point Schools is, I believe, the website. And also on New Visions for Public Schools. It was an enormous undertaking, and changed dramatically the opportunities for low-income students. More than 90% of our students in those schools are African-American and Latino. The students are graduating at much higher levels. MDRC, the Research and Evaluation Organization, did a random assignment study because there were naturally occurring lotteries, so they were able to do that, which showed the importance, and it held for all groups of students, including African-American males, which has been the hardest group to graduate at post-secondary readiness. So, and they're following them now into post-secondary education, continuing to get good outcomes. They really have a youth development approach embedded in them. The Murnane and Richard Murnane and Greg Duncan book, Restoring Opportunity, also speaks to this as their high school experience in that book, and very much about building kids' social capital by expanding the opportunities that are available to them. Remember, kids need both supports and opportunities. They need caring relationships, but they need to do internships. They need to see what the world can offer them in some real way, so they get a chance to try on identities while they're in high school. It's really, really important. And I think there are opportunities for this in using school improvement grants from the federal government in Title I. And I would encourage people to, you know, be really thinking about what could the high school experience be for students in your communities. Another, let me give you a rural example as well. North Carolina New Schools Project has created about 80 early college high schools in partnerships with community colleges and other colleges throughout North Carolina, newly designed schools. And in one rural in Duplin County in North Carolina, a very rural area, a collaboration between the schools, the community college, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture Extension program to form an early college high school.
So, Michelle, this is Stephanie Krause with the Readiness Project, and the questions are starting to pour in here on Twitter. You gave some great school examples, and some folks on the line want to know about any informal learning spaces
Sure.
that you've seen that are pushing this work forward in high-quality ways.
Sure. I think that's I'm glad people asked this question. There's a whole movement for science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM education in the informal space, as well as in the school, and the entire maker movement is really critical for in the informal learning space. And when I was at Carnegie, we did a competition on the Ashoka platform. A-S-H-O-K-A, where people, Ashoka Changemakers platform, people can find the competition there, which was Partnerships in STEM Education. And Ashoka thought we would get about 80 proposals, maybe. And these are all partnership programs that are in the informal space, linking sometimes with schools, but driven by the informal education providers, often youth development providers in STEM education, about 254. And they were amazing kinds of experiences in which students are as I said, making, which is a sort of engineering kinds of programs. The whole design studios that NICTAF was doing. There are partnerships in California for opportunity youth in Berkeley that young people who've dropped out of school but who are gaining credentials through the maker movement and gaining into post-secondary. So there's those. In Providence, we have PASA, the partnership, the After School Alliance, mm-hmm. Providence After School Alliance, which has done an amazing job of informal education structured so that every young middle school student and most high school students have experiences outside of school that are critical for this. The arts are just teeming with these kinds of experiences. One of the challenges that I think has been explored mostly in Chicago, though it is spreading, has been to do this with digital education and have young people create everything from communications vehicles, whether those are digitally based digital media, whatever. But they have been taking on the challenge of getting this credited for school through portfolios. And I think that that's something that builds out of the youth communications work, like Keith Hefner's been doing in New York for a very long time, and with new youth communications. So I guess I could go on, but there's many.
So we had one other question that relates to this, and I wonder if you and Karen might tag team the question. You spoke to formal schools doing youth development, mm-hmm. informal spaces doing learning. There was a question about, as these things are becoming more infused, mm-hmm. is there a difference between development and learning?
Mm-hmm. Learning is, to me, a subset of development, or you could say you can't do, you learn, you develop as you learn. I mean, there's always arrows going both ways in these kinds of things. So for purposes of discussion or thinking, you can isolate, like, development that's intrapersonal, mm-hmm. right? And is that learning? Often learning is considered cognitive, right? So I think it's defined as cognitive learning. But we know so much more about how the brain works now mm-hmm. that I think both of those things, we're thinking about lifelong learning. We're thinking about continuous development. And I think this also comes from the notion that we have metacognition, or learning to learn. And that's really the ticket to future success, because all of us are going to have to be, learning to learn.
Yeah. I agree with everything that Michelle said, and I think it sums up, and this is why we're in such a special moment. I think historically we have defined had a huge space between development and learning, because we started the definition of learning from a content perspective, mm-hmm. and we said this is what you need to learn by this age,
right,
or grade. And then development, when we started out 30 years ago, was just this thing that happened. Because as you moved through life, you developed. And if we saw places where young people didn't seem to be getting adequate experiences, we tried to steer them over into those experiences for development. What we've learned, and now we have to apply it, is that learning, defined as we need you to learn this particular content, doesn't happen very well, and it doesn't stick very well unless there's motivation and engagement that goes along with it.
Right.
And what we've learned is that those things that we thought young people actually got naturally by osmosis can actually be practiced and taught,
mm-hmm.
that they're much more malleable than what we thought. And if we're mm-hmm. intentional about developmental practice,
right.
those things that we start to name, like they name them in the new tech high schools, those things that we actually start to name and say are important can be learned but the kind of learning experience that you need to have looks very different than the classroom that got defined when we said learning was primarily content. So it's one of the reasons that, while I understand it, defining this exciting new space and giving recognition to this broader set of skills and skill sets and mindsets that young people need to have, defining them by what they're not, non-academic, non-cognitive, does not do justice to them. We need to define them by what they are,
right.
And we need to link them in together. And I think that, to your first question, Stephanie, about we've talked about school, what about the informal systems? We're also at a place now where we can intentionally and officially make a transition from seeing after-school, out-of-school, summer programs defined primarily by when and where.
Right.
You know, here's a time that the school box doesn't fill and the school is closed, so where do these kids go? To really digging deep into what's the difference that they bring in terms of how and why. Because they're set up differently, because they're informal, they actually, without as much official practice over them, they allow you to quickly create a different kind of why, which can be motivated by the young person. I'm here to build something because I'm interested in building it, and I've got the space
right.
to be able to do it differently. Now, that doesn't mean we can't get a blending in between those, but we really are at a place, I think 20 years ago we wrote a paper called Blurring the Lines or something. We're at a place where we actually
pushing the boundaries.
Pushing the boundaries, blurring the lines. I think we've used every analogy you can think of
right.
to talk about this. But it does seem that it could happen. But I think we are going to have to really step up our game in naming what the challenge is.
Yeah, this may not be what the people who sent in that question are asking, but I've been asked it many times, which is, are we trying to take the informal space and make it school, right? And some part of the anxiety about that is that it will make the informal space less free, less opportunity for young person's choice, more bounded by outcomes that are input-output kind of thing. And we certainly have to push back against that because it is a space of great potential for innovation and great innovation that we're seeing. And also gives kids, young people, opportunity to try different things on in shorter time periods, which was just a lot less pressure, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also to practice combinations of skills, leadership along with music and, you know, other things. But from a conceptual design perspective, I think we want to be seeing a blending here, right? Because if the informal space is only defined against formal schooling, which by definition is arduous and boring, then we are forcing kids to be, for large portions of their lives, you know, in custodial places that are not intrinsically engaging to them. So we want to bring those engaging practices into school, but perhaps in a more structured pathway of fundamentals of what we need to have, and with entitlement across the board in the sense that everyone needs to get this, whereas you may have more choice about what divergent pathways we want. Certainly we want equity in access in the informal space, but more opportunities to specialize, right? But it shouldn't disvalue the informal space, but in fact, we don't know where this is going in terms of potentials for different kinds of fluidity and how high school is defined, how many years. If you start organizing by mastery of different kinds of competencies, you can, say, with early college high schools, accelerate. There's all sorts of possibilities for learning that is blended.
Absolutely. So, you know, when we were describing how you got the work going in New York City, you used two words. You talked over here about sort of the design word and the opportunities that you provided to really have folks just think mm-hmm. against a set of design principles and standards, what would you do if you could design this thing? You also use the word assess. Mm-hmm. And so it seems that we have to have both, that people have to be able to have not just a blank piece of paper to say, go design a new thing,
right.
but to have the kind of sort of scaffolding that you provided
right.
To think about what design could look like to get to some explicitly rebalanced practices
yeah.
And goals. But we also have to have the assessments that let us be honest about the fact that what we're currently doing is really pretty crappy. So can you talk a little bit about assessment? And I want us to make sure we're talking about assessment both in school and in out of school, because
right.
while the likelihood is that the out of school experiences are probably a little bit better, just because young people can walk
yeah.
away from them if they're really bad, more easily, we're not trying to pretend that everything in the out of school space is wonderful and everything in the in school space is terrible. So talk about assessment and about specifically assessment of practice.
Right. And there are fantastic programs and there are fantastic schools and there are boring, non-engaging programs in schools as well. But we're talking about, when we talk about practices, we're a little bit in another space. But let me start with what assessment is in terms of school design. And I think it's very similar for program design, for having done both. You have to assess need, right? Where, and need has to be assessed against goal,
mm-hmm.
right? So the two things have to happen at the same time. I've seen programs that assess need and started bringing in treatment right away because kids have exhibiting depression, they're discouraged, they are acting out and doing too much risk-taking, inappropriate risk-taking that is dangerous for them, right? And immediately go to treatment, right? Assessment gets extremely complex around need and not around interest, right? So, and I think many of us who work with youth programs, particularly in the past, have seen that. High levels of specification about risk and very little understanding of kids' strengths or interests, right? So, but then, where do you want them to be? So, people have assessed in school and in programs and said, oh, we've talked to these kids and they don't really want to go to college, right? And so they haven't assessed, for example, what the workforce opportunities are in their community or in the country, so that you're not assessing the context that the young people are going into. And so the gap isn't available to you.
Mm-hmm.
They actually need to gain more complex critical thinking skills and others because, and I could give many examples of this, but let me just tell you a really easy one, which is people wanted to do, the kids wanted to work with electronics and they were extending that they thought they could do this in an old-fashioned career technical program. Well, all of electronics is systems now. They have to be systems thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
They have to understand coding in certain ways. Right? It's a very different kind of gap. So understanding need, understanding goals, understanding whether you call that standards, like learning standards, or understanding the context of the future that kids are going into and what the gap is, and then designing around that. So if students are going to be, as most people will be, needing to work collaboratively in their future jobs, think critically on their skills, then they need to be practicing that in the program or in the school. So those kinds of assessments. You've got to assess literacy, you've got to assess math, et cetera. But within that kind of broader notion,
mm-hmm.
where you're going and what the student need is. Because then you would design school to recuperate faster for kids who are older and way behind, using a whole year, for example, making sure you're not losing the summer, all sorts of things that would change using time, technology, money differently.
There's a great question. This is Caitlin just breaking in here. There's a great question that came in. We're down to the last 10 minutes of the
right.
discussion, so please do keep sending questions to #ReadyYouth. But what about ways to allow youth to provide their own self-reflection and be involved and engaged in this assessment?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm feeling very guilty that I didn't say that before now. It's critically important. Youth voice is essential to this. That's a little bit what I was hinting at by understanding their interests, right? But it's also understanding their experience, right? We, as adults, often have a different understanding of what's going on in a situation than young people do. So their voices, their aspirations, but also their experiences are really critical. And they're critical not just in one instance. What's really important is in programs and schools to build in continuous youth voice. And youth as designers as well of their experiences. And once again, young people need the same kinds of information as adults do. It's not helpful to have youth voice alone if you're not giving them some information about the future or about what could be prospects for them in some way. If kids only know the word college and it's this abstract thing rather than the varieties of post-secondary, the pathways of how you get there, what kinds of careers are linked to what, they have much more opportunity to speak to what they would need to get there.
Very quickly, just to pick up on that, are there specific examples? You've shared some wonderful concrete examples. Are there youth-driven examples that come to mind? Ways that youth were not only sort of involved, but actually driving some of these?
Sure. What Kids Can Do is a really good site, as well as Jobs for the Future, JFF, Students at the Center. Give many examples of youth-driven kinds of efforts, and youth as organizers of change, I think, are also really important. And I think people can find on those sites some really good examples of youth-driven work.
So as we start to tie the pieces of this conversation together, Michelle, you talked about a lot of these competencies like collaboration and critical thinking, problem solving that are meaningful and important in life. Karen, you said they're malleable. Michelle, you talked about assessment. You're saying they're measurable.
Mm-hmm.
Is that really true? Are these malleable and measurable?
So malleable, we know so much more about now, the plasticity of the brain. And that's why I get so frustrated with people who think high school's too late. High school is absolutely not too late. It is a wonderful moment of malleability. Carol Dweck's research on mindsets, really important here, and really valuable for people to be thinking about in both schools and programs. Measurable is getting better. Okay, let me say it's getting better, but there's also dangers in it. So here's what I mean by that. We do have better performance assessments. Asia Society is working on this. International Baccalaureate, if you're in the school part. Not that everybody's using those curricular materials, but there's a range of things about in which there's a number of assessment scientists who are really trying to work on how you get content and critical thinking and problem solving assessed, or how you get those skills assessed inside certain kinds of content. There is a movement to assess socio-emotional skills, which I find somewhat intriguing and somewhat dangerous. And it's because it's separating it out and the capacity, as if they exist on their own. And also because we have great capacity in formal education to label kids. And we don't want to do that. That would be a step backwards. These are malleable, developmental, and they should not become part of kids' records, right?
Right.
So I think we want to be thinking about it always in the context of productive development towards some goal we have. So are they learning these skills rather than, this marking of kids where they are on this?
Yeah. I mean, I would jump in to say I would be, to Michelle's point of you're both intrigued and sort of anxious because it could be dangerous, I'm much more on the dangerous side, mm-hmm. Especially when we're talking about schools. I mean, we have such...
I agree. I did use the word dangerous.
You did. You used it. I'm just going to say, I'm going to let my being intrigued with cool things to measure sit over here on the side and just start and say, I don't think we're ready to do this because
the likelihood
that we're going to get it wrong is so high. When we're talking about measuring youth outcomes in this very new space that we're just beginning to get some codified language around and understand.
Right.
Now, observable, I would like to introduce that. I'd like to substitute measurable for observable, which is a much lower stakes thing, because what we're talking about, if these are skills that you have to practice to master, I should be able to see it.
Yes.
I don't want to give you a test on it. I don't want to give you a 4.2 score on it. I just want to be able to, in that old-fashioned way that teachers used to write on your report card, you know, Michelle really speaks out too much in class. I want to be, not that you ever did, I'm sure you didn't, but I want to be able to really allow folks to really codify this stuff, know what it looks like when young people are progressing towards mastery, have very clear sort of anchor points on that, and get credit and provide room for providing that kind of observational feedback, which peers can do as well as adults.
I agree with you, Karen. Let me make a clarification to the way I was answering it before, and that has to do with problem solving and cognitive, like critical thinking, that I was distinguishing that from just content measurement,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
On the socio-emotional side, I agree with you. It needs to be observable.
Yeah.
This time.
Good. How are we doing on time check?
We've got 2 minutes left.
2 minutes left.
Time to start.
All right, this is our 2 minutes to be totally inspiring. So, Michelle,
this
is
such
an inspiring thing. Do you want to say?
Such a moment of opportunity. This is such a moment of opportunity for people from the informal sector and the youth development world to influence schooling. And the stakes are so high for our young people. The world is changing so rapidly. The careers that they are out there for them require this integration of cognitive capacities and developmental capacities that enable them to manage the world, manage their own lives, and to continuously learn. And school has got to be a place in which they learn to learn, they build confidence, and they have a sense of who they could be in the world and a pathway to get there. And in communities, we need to take bold, more adult risk-taking than we have seen in order to fulfill our obligations, our responsibility to our young people, and to enable them to be leaders for their own futures as well.
Well, I'm inspired, and I'm going to say that the two categories, we've talked a lot about school, you just basically said informal learning, after school, out of school for folks, it's time for you to really raise the bar and step up your game. You've got an opportunity to inform this space, but you can't just do it with anecdotes. So I want to make sure that the next time we come back for another totally unscripted, totally inspiring conversation, we'll bring in Charles Smith from the Weikert Center for Youth Program Quality, who's been working with Reed Larson and a team of wonderfully mature and diverse youth organizations around the country, 9 of them, from everything from boat making to youth advocacy to teen pregnancy prevention, but doing what we would say is high quality work in this space and unbundling over the past 2 years how even in their space they have figured out how to bring that sort of implicit curriculum about how we develop these skills and competencies and skill sets and mindsets, how we develop that and bring that implicit curriculum up into their own homegrown curricula focused on whatever they were focusing on. And what they're doing is really trying to turn that into standards that practitioners can use, rich, rich examples that we can read and ways to really make that happen in terms of practice and practice models. So we'll bring that back. So we'll answer this question of, you know, how do we do this outside of schools, and how do we continue to push the boundaries and blur the lines. So Michelle, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Joining us.
And everyone on the phone. Appreciate
it. Instructions, Caitlin?
Yes, thanks everyone for listening to this very inspiring conversation. It's going to be a challenge, but we're going to have a recap that we'll do of the key points from the conversation, and you can have a full recording, so you can go back and listen to some of the inspiring and informative moments at sparkaction.org/readiness. Again, it's sparkaction.org/readiness, and all of you on the phone will get a direct link to this recording when it's posted. Thank you again. We'll send out an email to all of you that also includes the abilities and practices that we mentioned at the very beginning, that very fun and colorful guide, as well as some other takeaways from the call. If you have other questions for either Karen or Michelle or any of us, and or if you have speakers to suggest for future conversations, visit sparkaction.org/readiness or email me, Caitlin, Caitlin, at sparkaction.org. And thanks again, everyone.
Thank you.
Twitter activity. There's a great comment here that I thought I could share that. So we consider formal and informal learning. This Ready Youth Conference call may be considered informal, and yet I learned so much.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And then several other people said, this is a great conversation. Can we do this again soon?
There were a ton of people emailing me, Senator Lerner, the state policy people in Ohio and Colorado.
There's a bunch of policy
people. Practitioners who were saying,
hello, ma'am?
Yes, hello.
Hi, we had a total of 300 that joined.
That's great. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Great.
Are we all?
Are we all done? Can we hang up?
Yes, you can go ahead and disconnect your line. Have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Bye-bye.